You are listening to The Kevin Smith Show.
Comments and views expressed on The Kevin Smith Show are those of the people that make them and do not necessarily reflect the views of Kevin Smith, The Kevin Smith Show, or its affiliates or sponsors.
Hi, folks, and welcome to The Kevin Smith Show, whoever you are, wherever you are, all around this beautiful place we call Earth. Thanks for being here at The Kevin Smith Show. Some of you are joining us for the very first time tonight. Welcome aboard. I'm glad you're here. I think you'll be glad as well, and I hope you come back each and every night. A couple of quick announcements. Don't forget the seminar that's coming up. The seminar is all about this, okay? It's just very simply this. Darwin says A, creationists say B, and neither one of them has the support of the evidence they cite. There is an ancient document that tells a story. Maybe it's true, but that ancient document is used by one side. It's the document Genesis. The story it tells is not the story the creationists say it tells. That's what this seminar is about. It reads better. Look, I guarantee you it reads better than any Star Wars script you could imagine. It is phenomenal what it actually says. And that's what we're going to take a look at. K-Files E-Zine is our free weekly newsletter. And there's really no reason for you to be out of the loop. There's no reason for you to not know what's going on. It's free. There's no reason not to subscribe. And you can do so quite easily simply by going over to kevinsmithshow.com. kevinsmithshow.com is my website. And you'll see a little button that says K-Files E-Zine. Click that. And when you subscribe, you also will get an automatic reply from us with a link where you can download a free ebook called The Flying Saucers Are Real. You know, England, not just England, but the UK. The UK has really become a hotbed for UFO sightings in, I would say, within the past couple of years. And it seems like it's just increasing. But, you know, just within the past 48 hours or so, this photograph was taken. This photograph was taken by a construction worker, and you can see in the photograph four white oval shapes in the sky. I don't know if those are UFOs, but it certainly is a phenomenon that is way out of the ordinary. And then over around a place called Taunton, during the night, a young man saw a bright golden light that just appeared. He said it sort of zoomed in from space, and it was moving very, very rapidly and making all kinds of weird moves, and then shot off back up into space. He snapped a photo of it, and you can see that it was moving fast enough that in that single photo you get all this squiggly line, but then you see it shooting off or trailing off up into space. And, you know, just more and more and more, it seems like that the UK is the place to be if you wish to see UFOs. It seems like it is becoming quite a hot spot for UFOs. There are a few other hot spots around. Ed Grimsley says you can see UFOs almost every night with night vision. And he's going to be holding a seminar and night viewing, sky viewing, in Sedona, Arizona. He's going to be with us tomorrow night to talk about that in person. Tonight, Lloyd Auerbach, and we're going to be talking about the paranormal. We'll be back right after this. And welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. As I said, my guest this evening is Lloyd Auerbach, and he's quite an interesting individual. He's been with us before, and it's always a privilege to have him back with us. He has a master's degree in parapsychology. He is a professor at JFK University. He is the director of the Office of Paranormal Investigations. He is also the creator of the Certificate Program in Parapsychological Studies. He is a published author. You have seen him on television and heard him on many talk shows. Lloyd, welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show.
Thanks, Kevin.
Lloyd, you're quite an interesting guy. A lot of people try, I mean, this happens all the time, a lot of people would try to turn the whole idea of the paranormal into sort of a chuckle. There you are out there bringing the study of the paranormal up to what I think anybody would say would be respectable standards, even in academia. So let me kind of begin there with how did you get into that position, and you know what brought you to this place?
Well, kind of what brought me to parapsychology was an interest as a kid in psychic phenomena, psychic abilities, and I was encouraged by a couple of my science teachers in high school, and getting a chance to meet a couple of parapsychologists in the New York area when I was in high school really kind of focused my attention on this field of study that needed more. I really felt like really curious about psychic abilities, but not from the weird sense, but more from the human potential perspective.
What do you mean by that?
I kind of looked at.
What do you mean when you say from the human potential perspective?
Well, psychic experiences, psychic abilities, and research in parapsychology suggest very strongly that human beings have greater limits. I guess you could say the limits are further out for us than what society tends to accept. That we have the ability, we have in us the potential for being able to connect with the environment, connect with each other a lot more directly than just using our hands and communications devices. So think of it as that we have the potential to be not Superman, but, you know, superpowered in that sense.
Do you think that everyone has those abilities, Lloyd?
Everyone has some form of the abilities. It's kind of like there's a connection in research between, and kind of a parallel between creative talent and psychic ability. People who are creative and express their creativity tend to be more psychic, whether they're aware of it directly or not. And people who tend to shut that down, that creative process down, tend to be less psychic. And you can be creative without being in the arts. I mean, you can be creative in science, you can be creative in business, but there's that openness to new ideas, to taking in new information that makes a big difference. And so everybody has potential, perhaps not for the same abilities, just like not everybody can have the potential to play every musical instrument, just certain ones. We seem to have talents in certain directions.
Okay, so one person maybe would have an ability toward telekinesis, another towards telepathy. So just because a person exhibits some abilities in these areas doesn't mean that, for instance, if they're telepathic, doesn't mean that they would have the ability to do telekinesis.
That's right. right. And there is what's really interesting is that from a perspective looking at telekinesis or psychokinesis is the term we use typically, there is some component of that process that involves ESP anyway. So whether it's clairvoyance or some form of telepathy, there's a component of psychokinesis. So it's more likely that someone who's psychokinetic might have some of the informational ability, but someone who picks up on current objects, on things, people, events, real time, which we call clairvoyance, remote viewing, whatever, may not necessarily be that telepathic, or, more importantly, is likely not necessarily to be precognitive. And that whole precognitive focus that the general public has, and seemingly every skeptic out there says, well, how come they can't predict this? That's kind of a rough ability to begin with, because the future is changeable, is mutable.
So you could be right and be wrong at the same time if you're precognitive. You could say, okay, well, this is what I see coming. Then someone does something that changes the chain of events.
Right.
It doesn't happen. People say, well, you were wrong, but in fact you were right.
You may be picking up, and this is one possible definition of precognition, is that we're picking up on potential future rather than the actual future. You're wrong if the future is predetermined, but we don't think the future is predetermined. It seems to have potentialities to it. It's kind of like, you know, if every day people, just about every person in the United States, Canada, all over the world, in most countries who have technology at all of some kind, seek out an oracle just about every day, and they pay attention to this oracle, and this oracle tells them, gives them information that helps them determine what to wear and what might be happening throughout the day. And the oracle likes to predict many days in advance, and the further out you go, the less likely that oracle is to be correct. And that weather guy, that oracle, is basing everything on a scientific model, supposedly. But there are unseen, the further out you get from the predicting time, the more potential other things in the climate of the world, the environment of the world, could affect that local model and cause your prediction to be incorrect. It's the same thing with precognition.
Yeah, you know, I grew up in Dallas, Texas, and in that area, at this particular point in my life, I was riding a motorcycle all the time, and so I did exactly what you said. I paid attention to the weather guy every day. If they said, we have a 20% chance of rain today, what you needed to do is go back in the house and get your scuba gear, because it was going to flood. If they said, we have an 80% chance of heavy rain today, put on your shorts and T-shirt and enjoy the sun. They were wrong almost all the time. However, I moved out of that area, and in other places where I've lived, they've been very correct, and what you say is exactly right. If they tell you that today it will be, like here in Phoenix, this is easy to predict in the summertime, well, we're going to hit 115 today. Okay, you will. But if they predict for 3 weeks in advance, give you a long-term forecast, it's likely not to be accurate. And what you're saying is that the same is true with precognitive abilities.
That's correct. The further out you go, the more unknown decisions are being made, the more unknowns that could affect the equation.
All right. Now, let me get into the Office of Paranormal Investigations. What is it? What do you guys do?
Well, it's a group that was started as an outgrowth of the old graduate parapsychology program at John F. Kennedy University. Our graduate program, unfortunately, ended in the late 80s, and at the same time, it was pretty clear that people were still needing help with their potential ghosts and related problems. So a couple of us, myself and several of the students who were graduates at the time, created the Office of Paranormal Investigations, which really is kind of a loose, it's a group. I mean, the office, you might say, is in my home. And a lot of the files, people look for filing cabinets and such. It's like, well, you know, files are kept electronically these days, generally. But typically, what we've got is a group of people, and the membership it changes a little bit based on my student groups and the graduates and what people move on to. I've got a group here in the Bay Area that focuses mainly on cases here in the Northern California area. And then I have affiliated investigators, people who I work with or refer directly to in a few other parts of the country and even in a couple other places overseas.
All right. Now, this is, the whole thing about paranormal investigation has really become popular. There are several television shows now. And that's in the United States. In the UK, there are also television shows about paranormal investigation. The same thing is true in Australia. I would assume there are in Canada, but I don't know for sure.
Yeah, there are in Canada.
Okay.
Yeah.
But I mean, it's all over television now. It's a big thing. People are interested in it. Here is something that I have always wondered, and you're the guy that can answer this. Are UFOs considered to be paranormal?
Well, if you take the definition of the word paranormal to mean on the side of normal, then you might consider them paranormal. Actually, when it comes right down to it, psychic experiences are so numerous. If you go by the numbers,
mm-hmm.
It's not paranormal at all. It's actually very normal. It's mm-hmm. just not accepted. But the term paranormal has been used in and around psychical research and parapsychology since the late 1800s. When people are connected at all to psychic functioning, psychic phenomena, the only connection really that pops up with UFOs might be that there could be ancillary psychic experiences with the UFO sightings, and some people have posited the idea that some UFOs are not nuts and bolts hardware, but actually psychic projections.
Okay, and that is why I brought this up, because there's also this, and you sort of mentioned it. Many people who claim that they have had personal contact with the occupants of these UFOs say that they communicated with them. These occupants, these extraterrestrials, communicated with them telepathically.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of these folks, and this is where your expertise comes in here, a lot of these folks say that they had never had any psychic ability prior to that contact, but that the being spoke directly into their minds. Okay, now are these people, if they've never had a psychic kind of experience or ability before that they recognize, are they imagining this, or has something actually happened that's phenomenal?
Unfortunately, there's no way to know, because you're talking about them. It's not the telepathic contact, it's the actual experience itself, whether that was real. There are certainly enough models in science fiction, comic books, movies, television, for the last, 70 years that talk about telepathy. In fact, you look at back in the 60s, there was a great TV show, comedy show called My Favorite Martian, and he was telepathic.
Mm-hmm.
And that whole model is inured in the culture, so you certainly can't say whether someone's experience was real based on their description of mind-to-mind communication. It's just so much in the culture.
Now, through the years, have you run into very many people who have said that, they had no psychic, none that they recognized anyway, psychic ability, and then they had this contact, and after that, they had psychic ability. Have you run into that?
I have not had anybody come to me with that. I really focus on the psychic experience, and while I was interested in UFOs in college, and even volunteered at the Center for UFO Studies in Evanston, Illinois, when it was there under J. Allen Hynek. I really, that's not my area. So we don't have people come to us with UFO experiences, and I can't recall anybody who's ever expressed that. Other people who have been in accidents, or had a near-death experience, or something traumatic in their life, have expressed psychic openings. And, we don't study the accident. We study the result of the accident, which is a psychic opening or the psychic abilities.
Okay, but why does the traumatic event seem to create this psychic opening?
It seems to, in some instances. It also creates other issues for people. It seems like, for whatever reason, some people under stress, certain blocks that that are naturally there, that are kind of programmed into us as we grow up, drop out. And for some people, a trauma puts them in enough of an altered state, or perhaps does something to the brain. It's hard to know exactly what's happening here. But there are a number, for example, near-death experiences, which are, of course, not death experiences, but near-death, you know, their brain hasn't stopped functioning. The brain is still functioning. About 15% of the cases of near-death experiences, people have profound philosophical shifts, and a good number of them claim to have or talk about having psychic experiences increase after that. But it's the way that they look at the world, not necessarily the trauma that did that.
One of in years gone by, back when there was a Soviet Union, they were one of the leading nations on the planet, apparently, in doing research into the paranormal and into psychic phenomena.
Spending the money.
Yeah. Now, have you taken a look at any of that old research they did?
There certainly is some interesting stuff. A gent by the late Milan Rizal, who was a researcher from Eastern Europe, and there was another woman we had working in the field here in the Bay Area, Larissa Vilenskaya, talked quite a bit about it. Stan Krippner, who is at Sabrek Institute currently, had been over to the USSR. And several people looked at their research, and there was some good research, but there was a lot of crazy research, because a lot of this, what the Soviets did was to look for applications, unfortunately, for mind control, telepathic hypnosis, harming people at a distance, a number of things that really just didn't work. So they spun their wheels quite a bit. But certainly in other areas, they had some successes. Nothing more necessarily than we've had here in the States or in England.
Do you think that that there is any one nation on the planet today that is ahead in terms of psychic phenomena research and paranormal research, or is it about equally distributed around the world?
Well, I wouldn't say it's equally distributed, because there's a very small number of researchers who are even willing to do parapsychological research. There's no funding to speak of, so this is a really small number. The Parapsychological Association is under 200 people at this point, and there are others besides those researchers. And there are certainly people who are doing, perhaps, research without letting their colleagues know about it, because they're afraid of academic lashback. But it's, I think that you can say certainly that there's probably more people in the United States and the UK than the rest of the world combined. And from an educational standpoint, there are more schools in the UK than anywhere else in the world.
More schools dealing with the parapsychology?
Multiple courses in parapsychology.
Uh-huh. Why do you suspect they have more?
Well, mainly because most of the folks who have been able to get into universities, there's over 20 universities now, there are graduates of the Kessler Unit in Parapsychological Studies through the Department of Psychology at the University of Edinburgh, Scotland. And that was the bequest of the late Arthur Kessler, the philosopher Arthur Kessler, established that unit, and the ability for people to do research and students had the ability, and still do, to do PhD work in parapsychologically related topics.
All right, we have to take a break. We'll be back right after this break. Don't go away, folks. And welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show and to my guest, Lloyd Auerbach. Lloyd, when we went away for break, we were just getting into this thing about the schools in the UK that offer academic programs in parapsychology.
Right.
What are we talking about when we're talking about academic programs in parapsychology? What do you study?
First, they're not full programs in parapsychology. You can do research in that area. But the courses vary mainly about everything from the history of psychical research in parapsychology, what it was founded on, what has been learned, what the research has covered both in the field and in the laboratory. There are courses typically involving laboratory methods, how to do research in this area. There are often courses in field investigation and conceptual and theoretical model type courses. I mean, these are all similar courses to what I teach. I teach very basic level versions of these courses, and I took graduate level versions of these courses myself back when John F. Kennedy University had its parapsychology program years ago.
All right. Now, when we talk about parapsychology, is that synonymous with paranormal?
Well, what we study is psychic abilities, which are considered by, and psychic experiences, which were considered by people to be paranormal. But it's not synonymous. I mean, there's people toss around the phrase paranormal psychology, which I know makes most psychologists cringe and makes parapsychologists cringe as well, because parapsychology is a separate field from psychology, although we do use some of the methods of psychological research, and certainly psychology is involved, but we also incorporate research work from physics and anthropology and other fields as well.
Okay. Now, the reason I bring that whole thing up is you were talking about near-death experiences. And there have been a number of psychologists that have written papers and even books having to do with these near-death experiences. And I wonder if they, as psychologists, are more or less qualified to be writing about near-death experiences, more or less qualified than parapsychologists.
Well, actually, a number of the books that are out there on near-death experiences are also written by medical doctors, because they've been the ones who have been told what the experiences are by their patients. You know, parapsychologists and psychologists, most of the members of the Parapsychological Association are trained in psychology. So I'd say that probably two-thirds of, of that organization. Who's qualified? Well, there were surveys of groups of people in different fields of science, social and physical science. And the group that turned out to have the most openness towards psychic experiences and psychic abilities and parapsychological research turned out to be physicists. And the group that had the least openness to concepts within parapsychology and the research were psychologists. So there may be an innate bias among psychologists to begin with, which would, I would say, makes them less qualified, but it depends on the psychologist.
Well, psychology, you know, there are all different kinds, all different models of psychology, but
absolutely,
it's the two basic camps are behaviorists and humanists,
right.
And I guess if you adopt one or the other as your model, your working model, then you try to make everything fit the model, and I would think anything that could be classified as paranormal is something that doesn't fit the model.
Yeah, it actually would fit further into the subdivision of humanistic psychology called transpersonal psychology, which incorporates those kinds of extraordinary experiences. But behavioral psychology is kind of aligned with neurology and neurological research, which looks at the brain as the end-all, be-all very often. You know, there's a fundamental question here, and really parapsychology is a study of consciousness and how consciousness interacts with the rest of the world, whether we're talking about using consciousness reaching out and grabbing information, or consciousness existing after the death of the body, what we call ghosts, or consciousness affecting things directly, which is what we call telekinesis or psychokinesis. So we study that, whereas psychology doesn't study consciousness. And we're studying one part of what consciousness displays as an ability, but psychologists study behavior generally, and they may bring in some of those experiences as well. But in some respects, it makes no surprise that physicists are interested, because quantum physicists are interested in the concept of consciousness and how that interacts at the quantum level. So really, parapsychology is looking at who we are with a mind-brain dualistic perspective, whereas behaviorists and the mechanistic biologists and the neurologists very often pursue this from a monistic brain is all, you know, you're a meat robot, basic perspective.
Yeah, and, you know, forever, the big question in psychology has been the definition of the mind.
Right.
What is it? And even, does it exist? And so, you know, I would think that a person's position on that question would have a big impact on whether they were open to studying things that are termed as being paranormal. Are you familiar with the work of Dr. Emoto from Japan?
Yeah, I am.
I would think that on a physical level, he's pretty much proven the existence of consciousness.
Well, he has not, first of all, his research needed to be replicated. It was replicated by the Institute of Noetic Sciences, and it's been replicated in other ways. And what it suggests is that there's an effect of consciousness or the mind or something about us affects things around us. I mean, the idea of proving the existence of consciousness without even a definition of consciousness is going to be kind of tough. But there's definitely a correlative effect for sure.
Well, yeah, but, you know, proving that you exist is tough.
I think it was the writer Ambrose Bierce who said that the mind is the only thing that defines itself and measures itself.
Mm-hmm. Well, a lot of people think it's a silly statement that I make. Of course, my background, before my life as a talk show host, I was a cop. Mm-hmm. And I spent years in court, and one case after another after another. And people think I'm a little loony when I say if you were forced to prove in court that you exist, it would be very, very difficult. You can't prove it. You can present evidence and ask people to believe it.
That's correct.
And, you know, at that level, your existence is a matter of faith.
No, I completely agree with you. There was an episode of Star Trek The Next Generation that was kind of one of my favorites, that which was called Measure of a Man, which the android Data was going to be taken apart, and there was a Starfleet, tribunal that was formed, and part of it was to determine whether Data was sentient. And it came down to Picard actually saying to the opposition who wanted to take Data apart, prove to me that you have a mind. Prove to me that you are sentient, that you are conscious. We only have our behavior, and it's all subjective.
Yeah. Now, I myself can experience the presence of my mind. Mm-hmm. You cannot experience the presence of my mind. You can only experience whatever behavior that produces.
Although, one of the things that parapsychology posits is that it is possible that your mind and my mind can experience each other's mind. That's telepathy.
Yeah, if consciousness is real.
Right.
Yeah. Now, and I think, for me, the evidence is in. For me, the jury is not out. I think there is scientific evidence that consciousness exists. And from several, Dr. Emoto is one of them. From several researchers. Dr. Gerald Epling is another. But being able to prove anything is almost at the point of being silly. You can't prove much of anything on this planet or in this universe.
Right. You only have acceptance by certain bodies of science or bodies of groups that end up providing you with more funding.
That's true. That's true. I had a very famous physicist on this show, and I said, in talking about the laws of physics, I said, isn't it true that there are no laws of physics? There are only descriptions of our current understanding. And he said, that's exactly right.
Yeah, that's right.
And I think that same thing applies when we're talking about parapsychology and consciousness. We can have descriptions of our understanding of them. But that's about as far as we can go. But let's talk about past life experiences now.
Mm-hmm.
Would that fall into the realm of parapsychology?
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, one of the groups that, one of the areas that there's been some considerable experience and research on has been reincarnation, and that's been done mainly by the group that is at the University of Virginia's Medical School, Division of Personality Studies. It's been going on since the 1950s, in fact, and Typically, the research has gone with kids under age 4 who spontaneously recall past lives, rather than the more popular version of hypnotizing someone to a past life, because that hypnosis brings up all sorts of contamination issues. With little kids who are 2 and 3 who suddenly start talking about past lives and sometimes can provide details, and there's no way they could have known it, then we have some really interesting situations. And there have been volumes published by Ian Stevenson and Jim Tucker and other folks since the early days of their research that really have great stories from all over the world, many of which were highly researched. So it is definitely something, because we're talking about the continuation of the soul, of consciousness. Consciousness reborn in this case. So it certainly falls into our bailiwick.
All right, we have a couple of minutes here before our top of the hour break. Well, it's not top of the hour, but before our next break. Let's talk about these past lives of little children. Mm-hmm. And I've seen some pretty good documentaries about this. Very fascinating, very interesting. Is there any... Has anyone come up with a definition or a description of how that could be going on without consciousness transfer?
There is a philosophical discussion, and sometimes might even say that a little war, mini war, going on in parapsychology, and has been going on for decades, and that is how powerful psychic abilities actually are. Because if there's no limit to being clairvoyant and telepathic, that little kid might not be remembering a past life. That little kid could reach out with his mind and get enough information to create, to simulate the past life. It ends up being boiled down to whether there's a limit and how complex that model is. And actually, many of us think that that model is just way too complex. But there's another issue here, and that is the how is almost difficult to figure out, but the why is really crazy to try to figure out, because not everybody apparently gets reincarnated. We have ghosts, obviously. We have people who are being talked to through mediums. There's all sorts of forms of the continuation of life.
I'm sorry, I have to cut us both off because our mics are about to go dead. We have a break coming up. We'll continue this on the other side of the break, though. Don't go away, folks. And welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. Welcome back to my guest, Lloyd Auerbach. Lloyd, we were talking about this war that is kind of going on between those who say that maybe these little kids are sort of psychically reaching out and constructing these past lives out of sort of the psychic ether out there.
Yeah, it's essentially a philosophical discussion. It's a basic philosophy between people who accept that there might be something to life after death or survival of bodily death, and folks who would rather put it in the realm of the living, which is exclusively. It's often called super psi, or the idea that we may have unlimited ability to pull information in. And this actually spills over into the ghost area as well. But many of us think that that's just making things overly complex, more than they should be, especially since we do have have conditions that make it unlikely for those reincarnation, those past life memories to actually have been constructed that way.
All right, why would it be unlikely?
Well, you have a very, very different context here. When a 3-year-old says, that he's getting information, or he says, I was, it's not even a recognition of memory. It's just like they seem to know that this was an actual past life as opposed to just throwing information out about things.
In other words, they differentiate the past life.
But to put it in the context of a different personality, because there's a different personality profile than the little kid itself that comes through as well. And it's different than, for example, some people suggested that perhaps these reincarnations are really people possessing the little kids. But again, these kids say, I was this person, not I am that person, and not here's the information.
Okay. So if they're saying, you know, I was John Doe, and I, you know, I lived in
Dayton, Ohio, and I was this businessman, and, you know, and...
How many of these little kids are there?
Say again?
How many of these little kids are there that, that have this?
Well, you know, it's impossible to even estimate. There are hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of cases on record, but these kids forget. Most of the most part, they forget as their real personality asserts itself. That's another thing, is it seems to go away by about age four, certainly by age five, from the vast majority of these kids. The numbers, I mean, the University of Virginia would probably be able to give you a number as to how many cases they've investigated, but how many there actually are out there will depend on how many get reported.
Well, would it be enough to say that it's not uncommon?
I think it's rare. It's, in certain cultures, it's more common than others, but that may be because parents just simply are unwilling to entertain even that notion if the kid starts talking about it.
I saw one on television. You probably are familiar with this, and I believe he was in the UK. And the investigator, the psychologist, actually took him and his mom to the place that he remembered, and he walked through the house and remembered. You know, who stayed in this room, who stayed in that room. You know, who the neighbors were, and a lot of information came from this kid.
Yeah.
So what do you think is going on with it?
I mean, I've seen some cases like that presented by other researchers that are just phenomenal in terms of the content, the information, and even if, I mean, the researchers go to great pains to find out if there is any possible other way of contamination, such as did the families ever have contact, that sort of thing. So it's really amazing when you get situations where the kid can take the parents, the kid's parents, to the location and identify everybody and even behave in a way that the other family recognizes that personality.
So what do you think is going on?
Well, in that case, it seems like consciousness somehow is either continuing on into a new body or is somehow being accessed. The person's consciousness itself is being accessed by that kid. Not information, but the consciousness itself.
Yeah, which way do you lean on that?
Well, I lean towards the continuation of consciousness. I do lean that way. That's from a personal perspective, just because I think it's a simpler explanation. But then again, I'm also one of those folks that leans toward the concept that ghosts or the idea of apparitions are consciousness without a body, and that, you know, there's a real good people's experiences and connections with this really do indicate this.
All right, among are in the world of ghosts. There are people that tell us that there are these beings that they call demons. And it seems, I mean, a lot of different religions have classified some beings as demons. Do they exist?
Well, not from a parapsychological standpoint. There certainly are people, let's face it, people are capable of horrendous acts.
Yeah,
there's no question about that. People are capable of wonderful altruistic acts as well. We have a potential for doing good or doing evil. My undergraduate background was in anthropology, cultural anthropology, and you know, evil as a force, as far as I'm concerned, doesn't exist as an actual force. But people can do evil, certainly. The idea of demons is not common to all cultures, and certainly the concept of demon in one culture is very different than the Christian theology that's there, the mythology that's out there. So mythology changes that concept, just as it does with angels. I find it fascinating that people talk about demons, and the next breath they talk about angels, and they haven't read their Old Testament because it's the angels you got to worry about, not the demons.
Well, and even, you know, when we say Christians or Christianity, I mean, that's a huge, that one Absolutely. Word covers a huge spectrum of beliefs. And even in that group, there are many different beliefs regarding angels and demons.
Absolutely.
And many different definitions of what those angels and demons are.
Right. That's exactly right.
Okay, now if evil does not exist objectively as a force, what is it that causes behavior that we classify as evil?
Well, I think, you know, we don't know enough about ourselves as human beings to identify what causes people to do evil things.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's predatory behavior, there's harmful behavior. You know, there are sociopaths, there are people who are not, who are normal, who can act out, and there's, as psychologists, therapists find, there's all sorts of reasons that push people towards evil acts sometimes. There's not necessarily any one thing that will do that, at least not that I've ever read about, except from the religious perspective, and even then, it doesn't really fall into any single category. But it just is, we are animals, and, you know, sometimes we do horrible things to people, just like predators do horrible things to other animals. The biggest problem here is that most animals, unless they're fighting for territory, don't do horrible things to people, to animals in their own species, territory and food. And let's face it, a lot of what's done evilly here by human beings is done for territory and food. So it's definitely animalistic, not evil, per se. You know, people ask me about an evil force. Is a shark evil when he attacks a human being? And the answer to that is, it's a terrible thing, but it's not evil.
Well, it's a terrible thing for the human.
Yeah.
It's lunch for the shark.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. You know, as back when I was a cop, I've worked a number, I mean just tons, of cases where there was violence against human. And a lot of times, you know, when you catch whoever did it and you ask, you know, why, you know, they'll just shrug their shoulders and say, I don't know.
Right, right.
And, you know, at first I thought they were just avoiding an answer, but after years of that, I became convinced a lot of people have no idea why they do what they do.
And this speaks back to what consciousness is and how much of our behavior when our consciousness is in a body is ruled by the brain chemistry, by the neural pathways, by the environment. So we don't really know. I mean, again, we're kind of stuck not even giving a good definition of consciousness at this point.
All right, we're racing up on a break here. And then we have a good long time before the next one. But Dr. William Glasser wrote a book called Reality Therapy. You're probably familiar with it, but basically...
Actually, no, I'm not familiar with that one.
Well, it's interesting. It's a kind of a mind-blowing book if you're into psychology. And it's a very short book. But he says, he's a psychiatrist, and he says there's no such thing as mental illness. He said there are organic problems that can be corrected with medication, and then there's bad behavior. And he said there's no such thing as mental illness. Whatever's going on can either be cured with medication or with behavior modification. We'll pick up there when we come back. All right, folks, more with Lloyd Auerbach. Right after this. And welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. My guest this evening is Lloyd Auerbach. And we're talking about probably some pretty deep stuff, but it all has to do with the realm of the paranormal. And why, you know, there are sometimes, Lloyd, I get email from people, and they say, well, I just can't understand why this doctor so-and-so or doctor so-and-so over here, just, you know, they've got their head in the sand. They're not looking at the evidence. And in fact, they may be, but the evidence has this big cloud of theories and models around it.
But, you know, there's a great lecture on available on YouTube. If people go to YouTube and type in Dean Radin, D-E-A-N-R-A-D-I-N, there's a lecture that Dean did on the on science and its taboo against psi. And it's a great lecture because it really explores the actual taboos that are within science amongst academics, amongst scientists, and how they just totally avoid looking at this question. And how non-scientific that is, actually.
All right, I want to go back to Glasser and his theory, because it could have a huge impact on the realm of parapsychology and the paranormal. Glasser is a psychiatrist. He used to be the psychiatrist, I believe it was for the entire prison system for California, but if not there, then I think it would have been probably Los Angeles or one of the big cities. But I think it was for the whole prison system. And he was sort of the chief psychiatrist. And he says in his book, Reality Therapy, there is no such thing as mental illness. Either you have an organic problem that's causing you to see things, hear things, and do things, and that can be corrected with medication, or you have a behavior problem, and it can be corrected with behavior modification. It would seem to me that that entire thing would rule out the possibility entirely of the paranormal, would it not?
Well, I think that's what it certainly sounds like to me. But you know, until fairly recently in time, the book that was a diagnostic tool. The test that's a diagnostic tool for mental illness, the DSM. The DSM-3 listed psychic experiences as an indicator of psychosis. They don't do so much in DSM-4 anymore, but you know, psychologists and psychiatrists have generally dismissed psychic-type experiences, paranormal experiences, as signs of brain chemistry imbalances, mental illness, or other things. So.
But you know, in fairness, it can be. I mean, again, back in my previous life in law enforcement, when I first began, we were required to spend our first year working in corrections. Even though we were full-fledged certified cops, we in our department, we had to spend a year working in corrections. And we had patients that they were inmates, but they were patients. I mean, there was no place to put them. And we had one guy that heard voices all the time until he was given his daily dose of lithium.
Right.
And then all that went away. And so in fairness, there are people that hear things and see things as a result of some type of brain chemistry imbalance.
The question then becomes, you know, we look at those things and say, what's the information that's coming through? If you're hearing voices and the voices you're hearing are giving you information you couldn't possibly have known, there still may be a filter of brain chemistry issues, but the actual source of the information that's being incorporated into your brain is from outside yourself and is basically psychic in that sense.
What if you're hearing voices that tell you to kill yourself? Now, this is a huge hypothetical, and I understand that. But you're hearing voices that tell you to kill yourself or to harm someone else. They give you lithium. The voices don't go away. Is that psychic, or do you have some kind of a brain chemistry problem still?
I can't imagine any... You know, this is where we get into this whole issue of external entities and such. I can't imagine people... that there are voices out there or entities out there that are running around telling people to kill themselves. It doesn't matter. On the other, you know, so it's probably a misdiagnosis. There may be something else going on in the brain. It could be the interpretation. I'd like to know what that voice actually said to the person, with whether it was kill yourself or there was something else coming through. But you certainly can't call it psychic without any sort of actual informational content at all. We can't make that assessment at all.
All right, now I want to go into paranormal investigation and get some information and couple it up with what we've talked about. In paranormal investigation, have any of the groups, your group or any other group, come up with tangible evidence, like video taken with an infrared camera that shows something moving and there was no person there that we know of? Anything tangible like that?
Well, let me ask you this question, since you're interested in UFOs. Has there ever been any video footage of a UFO that proves that the existence of an alien spacecraft?
No, but that's not where I'm headed. Nothing proves nothing. There's not any proof.
Yeah, there's...
But has that evidence been gathered?
Well, people claim that they have evidence of things like that. People have claimed that the voices they get in electronic voice phenomena are spirit voices. But there are alternative explanations, including photographic and electronic ones, that we have to consider. And unless there are other, I guess you could say, signs, other kinds of corroboration, things that we can correlate to that piece of evidence, then it's no better than I shoot a video into the sky. It's a clear sky, nobody's seeing anything, and I play the video back, and there's a saucer in my viewfinder, in the playback. I mean, that doesn't tell me, nobody saw the UFO, there's no other corroboration of that, it's just a piece of video footage at that point.
Yeah, but then there are films and video where everyone there saw it, and they got it on film, and it doesn't prove it's alien, it just proves that it's there, and here's the point.
Something, it was an unidentified flying object.
Yeah, and here's the point, though, and here's why I bring it up. If you have this evidence that, let's say you've got someone that, they're saying that they psychically can hear a voice, they can hear someone talking, and maybe even tell you what they say, and you pick up at the same time EVPs of a voice, and maybe you get a word or two that matches what the person has said the voice was saying. It would seem to me that although it does not prove the existence of a ghost or spirit, it would be a very strong indicator that this person is not experiencing psychological problems.
Absolutely. And that's where the technology comes in, that the technology used in ghost hunting and investigations, none of which is designed to detect anything paranormal, can provide independent corroboration that someone's experience has objective validity. What that experience actually is, what's causing it, is something we can't prove, but it's something we hypothesize on and try to figure out.
One of the most interesting, and look, I got to tell you something. I am probably the hardest person to convince of anything that you'll ever meet. I am totally noncommittal normally. And that's because of having been a cop. Someone tells you, hey, man, I saw a whale going down Main Street. Well, my mind tells me whales don't go down Main Street, but the guy says he saw it, so we have to go investigate and see, did a whale go down Main Street? And, it's not up to me to believe it or disbelieve it. It's up to me to go investigate it. And so that same thing sort of carries over into my life as a talk show host. Now, one of the most interesting things I ever saw was a movie called Dead Whisper. There's a psychic, Robbie Thomas. He's asking questions and then telling the people around him in the room with him what the spirit is saying to him. Independently, they picked up at the same time EVPs answering and saying what he just said it said. And in this movie, you see him ask it, you see him tell the group, and then they play the EVP. Mm-hmm. And in the EVP, you hear him ask, and then you hear the EVP answer. And, does this prove anything? Well, no, it doesn't prove anything, but it is a very, very strong indicator that he's not hoaxing this and that he is hearing what he said he heard.
It is a better indicator. I guess you could say the evidence has more weight because of that.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
So what type of instruments would you normally take into a paranormal investigation to provide that kind of corroboration?
Well, literally, first of all, the best independent corroborators would be human, because at least we're designed to pick this stuff up. So I'm not necessarily saying psychics, although we do work with psychics and sensitives, but other witnesses, especially people you can bring in who may not be considered psychic, but actually also pick things up. So that's one element. The things that have worked most consistently, although you need to know how they work and what they pick up, would be things like electromagnetic field detectors, because there have been correlations both in the laboratory and elsewhere to people's experiences. You know, the problem is that high EMF can also cause people to hallucinate, so that can give us an indicator there. But there at least are correlations with shifts in the electromagnetic field in different areas, different frequencies. So that's a good indicator right there. A lot of the problem, though, is that someone using any type of EMF detector needs to know what it picks up and its limitations of use. And so I've actually found probably more bad wiring in a home than I've actually found corroboration for paranormal experience.
A very strong electromagnetic field. And not just an electromagnetic field, but the properties of that field can cause people to hallucinate. It can cause people to feel ill.
Right.
It can cause people to feel cold as well. And one of the things that is that really plays havoc with you is if it's an electromagnetic source that is pulsing. And if it's pulsing, it really can play, it can wreak havoc with your system and really make you feel as if you're about to pass out.
Right. Well, there's another element here. There's another area of electromagnetic fields that the vast majority of ghost hunters and amateurs that are out there have no concept about. And that is the research of Michael Persinger, which came out of parapsychological research, showing that the Earth's magnetic field, which is where all of this comes from, by the way, for our investigations, but the Earth's magnetic field can cause people to hallucinate, and depending on how that field, the field strength and how it strikes your brain, and what angle it actually interacts with your brain, you'll have different kinds of experiences. And most electromagnetic field detectors do not detect the geomagnetic field, and it has to be on a very local level. So there's some other aspects we have to kind of consider. At the same time, geomagnetic fields seem to correlate to people's experiences in the sense that if it hits you the right way, it can cause you to be more psychic.
All right, I'm digesting that. How does it cause you to be more psychic?
For some reason, in certain highs and lows of the localized geomagnetic fields, people tend to report more experiences. For example, when there are highs in the geomagnetic field locally, there are more PK, you know, psychokinesis experiences, typically more precognitive experiences, and even more ghost experiences. At lows of the Earth's magnetic field, there tend to be more telepathic and clairvoyant experiences. And now, let me just say that we're not just talking about in real life, but also even in the laboratory. There are those correlations, too. And they're not clear correlations, but in other words, they're not proven correlations, but they certainly there's a lot of evidence building for these kinds of things. And when I say that these people are having these experiences that seem to be psychic, let's say that you had a high geomagnetic field that caused you to hallucinate a ghost. The question for us would be, does that hallucination communicate with you and provide you information that you could not possibly have known? That makes it psychic, because in a typical experiment using the magnetic fields to cause people to hallucinate, there's no verifiable information coming through.
If an electromagnetic field, say you walk into one, and it switches on a heightened awareness, a heightened ability that you have, but it just sort of heightens and sharpens that ability, and you see a ghost, I don't think that just because you were in an electromagnetic field, that makes it less real.
No.
That's like saying, you know, out here in Arizona, you know, it hits 120 degrees sometimes in the summer. And it's hot. It's really hot. All right, you walk in the house and you stick your hand in a stove. It's hotter. And you stick it into an oven. It's hotter. Okay. Now, the fact that the stove was on, the oven was on, and there was electricity going through it doesn't mean that it wasn't really actually hotter. It really was, and that's why it was.
Right.
And so I would think that if a person is already, if they've already got that ability to see spirits or talk with spirits, and they walk into an electromagnetic field and it sharpens that ability, that doesn't make it less real.
No, of course not. It's think of it as an amplifier. But mm-hmm. It's even more than that. It's not, you don't even necessarily need to have that ability already, in the sense that you may not have had any psychic experiences before. This may be a trigger for you to have psychic experiences. And some of it may not be psychic. There's an element here, because Persinger's work shows how the brain is affected mm-hmm. to cause these hallucinations. But what's missing from a lot of the lab work is what people report in the field. So let's take the Gettysburg battlefield, for example. Thousands of people over the years have had experiences of seeing and hearing what appear to be recreations or reimaginings of past events, actual events. When Ted Turner's folks shot the Gettysburg miniseries back in the 1980s, I talked to several people who were extras, one of whom was an actor on the show, and a lot of them camped out there, and they were waking up in the middle of the night to use the porta-potty, and they'd see soldiers marching through their tents as if the tents weren't there. And it took them very little time to realize that they were actually seeing the past. They weren't actually seeing conscious ghosts. So we would call that a haunting or place memory. And it may be that the Earth's magnetic field allows you, or something about the localized magnetic field, doesn't have to be a geomagnetic field, but that EMF allows your brain to pick up on actual information in the environment, imprinted in the environment. That's a line that we're pursuing a little bit.
I have heard, I remember this both from high school and then from some college classes that I took, that every sound that has ever been made caused a vibration in the air. That vibration struck other material, rocks, walls, etc. Whatever it struck, it caused a vibration in it, and to whatever minute degree, it is still vibrating and theoretically possible to play it back.
Yeah, but if that is still happening, because there are a lot of folks in physics who would disagree with that, except mm-hmm. perhaps you can point it towards the quantum level. Because
mm-hmm.
sound does require vibration.
Mm-hmm.
And it may be that those vibrations are there, but you'd have to probably go down to the quantum level to pull that information out.
But perhaps that's what's being pulled out.
Absolutely.
And played back.
Well, it wouldn't, remember, it's not just sound. We're also talking about people actually seeing things.
Well, light is a vibration as well.
Yeah, but the physics of light are such that it's not the light. There's something else happening. There's some other information. And quantum physics recently has shown, in fact, there was a cover article of Discover magazine, I believe the February issue, talked about quantum entanglement and quantum tunneling as possibly being an explanation for photosynthesis, for the sense of smell, that there's an information transfer happening at the quantum level through what we call quantum entanglement, which is the idea that two particles that have ever been associated with each other can transfer information at faster than the speed of light. The question has always been, how does that get to our heads? How does that get to our consciousness? And that's something that is being looked at right now.
All right, let's go back and talk about hallucinations for a moment. How do we know that When a doctor says, well, he's hallucinating, how do you know that? How do you know that a hallucination is a hallucination? How do you know that some...
All perception is a hallucination.
I'm sorry?
Technically, all perception is a hallucination.
Okay.
And in the sense that when you're hearing my voice right now. If you were with me, you would see me. What you're looking at right now, what people are seeing, hearing, smelling, feeling, we have sensory organs. We actually have more than five senses. I mean, if you just want to count proprioception, which is the sense of balance, the sense of sensing where you are in space, we have six senses right there, but we actually have multiple senses of taste and multiple sensors for touch and so on. The information goes into our brains, but it gets translated by the mind-brain process. There's a perceptual process. So that people, their eyes are probably picking up more than they're actually seeing, and your ears are definitely picking up more than you're consciously aware of. Same thing goes with smells and touch and so on. And so we have essentially a subjective perception of the world that is based on data that comes in through our normal senses, but how we each perceive it is essentially a construct. It's a hologram. It's a hallucination.
Yeah. So what meaning does it have, really, when a psychiatrist or a psychologist says that so-and-so is suffering from hallucinations?
I think that that's an easy way to explain things without giving an explanation.
Thank you. I do, too. I think it says nothing.
Like giving somebody drugs is a cop-out.
Yeah, I think it says nothing. And I think that there are people who have seen things that maybe right here in the room with me, they might see a spirit, might see a ghost. They're not hallucinating. They have an ability to see what I do not have that same ability to see.
And I think it's important to remember that they're not actually seeing it with their eyes. They are perceiving it in a visual sense, but their eyes may not be picking it up.
Well, and I think that's a whole lot like someone that's colorblind.
Right.
Maybe I see a red shirt, but the person next to me sees that same shirt as white.
Well, here's another example. There is there's a couple of illnesses, and they're called illnesses often. One is called synesthesia, which your senses pick up gets scrambled by the brains, by your brain's processes, and so you hear color and you taste light. You might smell sound. It's just things get mixed up. And there's another disorder which I remember seeing on some news program years ago. You know, when our eyes see something, the image that's on the back of our eyes is reversed. It's upside down because a lens will reverse, invert an image. So it's upside down. And there are some people, for whatever reason, their brains are wired in such that they don't get to have it reversed again. So they see everything upside down.
Do they know it's upside down?
It depends on whether it came on in life early or later. I mean, if this happened to you while you were an adult or even a child, you would have had something to compare it to.
All right, we have to take a break, and we'll be back right after this.
It's upset, burned like a cigarette. Was it lonely for you? Just waiting for your time. Bending in and out of tune, burst like a big balloon. Couldn't take anymore. No reason to the rhyme. I was chained to the floor. I was chained to the floor. Oh, 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 oh. I was chained to the floor. I was chained to the floor. Oh, 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 oh. Chained to the floor. This whole wide world got me tied down and straight and gone. I was stuck down in a hole, and I feel about to lose control.
Most of the great music you hear right here on Steel Eye Media Network is supplied by the independent artists from GarageBand.com. If you hear a song you like, go over to GarageBand.com, look it up, download it. You can even buy the group's CDs, in many cases, right there at GarageBand.com. And welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. My guest is Lloyd Auerbach. And Lloyd will kind of wrap up what we were just talking about, and then I'll open up the telephone lines. We'll continue talking, but we'll allow the audience to call in with any questions they may have. If a person is born with the situation that you described, where their brain doesn't reinterpret everything, Are they aware of the fact that they're seeing things upside down?
Well, you know, that's comparative in the sense that if somebody's born blind, are they aware they can't see?
Mm-hmm.
They have nothing to compare it to. The answer is people tell them that they're seeing things upside down.
Now here's my question. How do they know that?
How do they know they're seeing it?
How would someone else know if I'm seeing things upside down?
Well, someone who's blind would have to take it on faith that other people can see. To them, it's all based on what the world around them says. So, you know, they're seeing things upside down, and this is a very rare condition. First of all, a prism will actually allow them to see things right side up. That would be, it's very correctable in that sense with glasses, more or less. But it's like, you know, if you are blind all your life and you suddenly have an operation that tells you, that allows you to see, and someone has to teach you about the world, has to teach you to see. So what someone points to and says, this is blue, well, how do you know they're telling the truth?
Exactly. Perception is a huge, huge, huge player in human experience, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And what's really interesting is that people talk about objective reality and objective experience and subjective experience, and really, it's all subjective. When a scientist looks at objective data, his interpretation is subjective.
Well, that's exactly right, and I've said that on this show that, you know, any alleged laws of science are flawed right from the start, right from Jump Street. They're flawed because whatever those laws are described as being, it's based on the observations of a person or a group of people, and observations by humans are flawed, imperfect. And so we can only say about these laws that they are an approximation of what was observed.
Well, this is why we end up with a consensus of reality,
mm-hmm.
as opposed to an actual knowledge of reality.
Now, one last thing before I open the telephone lines. The way this plays into the world of the paranormal, and even into the world of UFO investigation, is that when the skeptics and the ridiculers come along with these hard, fast, black and white rules and say that precludes this being a reality, we can know for sure they're not accurate.
Right. That's right. I think that people, you know, let's face it, people take things on faith, including disbelief.
Mm-hmm.
And there are, I find it really almost amusing, although it's sad, that some of the alternative explanations that have been applied to ghosts that have been so embraced by skeptics came from parapsychological research, which they didn't support to begin with. So, for example, recently, you know, although it's been known in Hollywood for decades, low-frequency sound can cause people to feel very anxious. And it actually can cause more than that. Vic Tandy, who was a researcher in England, in 1998 published a paper showing that, you know, just basically illustrating that low-frequency sound not only causes you to feel anxious, but therefore making you think that there's a, if there's a standing low-frequency wave, that you might feel like the place is haunted. But also can actually vibrate your eyeball at the 18, 19 hertz level so that you'll see things out of the corner of your eye, shadows out of the corner of your eye. After he did subsequent research in the literature, he found a little-known paper that NASA put out in the 1970s that from research that showed that low-frequency sound can vibrate the eye and make you see things out of the corner of your eyes. A few years later, that low-frequency sound thing, I think I had a call from Associated Press in like around 2002, 2004, that a group of Swedish scientists, they want to know my reaction to this group of Swedish scientists had proven that ghosts were a result of low-frequency sound. And my reaction was, they probably didn't cite the paper from 1978, did they? Or did they cite NASA's research? And they probably should talk to John Carpenter, and movie directors have been using low-frequency sound to freak people out for decades.
Well, you know, maybe their research proves that you can cause people to see things, but it doesn't mean that precludes the reality.
That's the point. There are multiple, many ways to get to the same result. I am a performing psychic entertainer besides being a parapsychologist. I used to be a magician. I learned that because of the skeptics. And there are many ways to saw a lady in half, and they can all look exactly the same result with different methodologies.
Yeah. Well, you know, when Star Wars first came out, you know, that was the leading edge for special effects at the time.
Right.
Nobody had ever done anything quite like that before. Just because you can put makeup on someone and make them look like, what was his name? The Wookiee? Chewbacca.
Yeah.
Just because you can make someone look like Chewbacca doesn't preclude the possibility of a Chewbacca out there somewhere.
Well, I mean, how many people have we seen on TV and in movies with bad gorilla suits and suits that made them look like real gorillas?
Yeah.
That didn't preclude the existence of gorillas.
Has nothing to do with the existence of gorillas.
Right. Yeah. Hollywood can duplicate all sorts of things, including maybe making people think there's an earthquake.
Have you ever been to a 3D movie?
Oh, yeah.
You know, even though your mind knows this is just a movie, some monster jumps off that screen in 3D toward you, and you'll react to it.
Well, even in 2D, I remember reacting to the shark the first time it popped out in Jaws.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, the telephone lines are open, folks, and the telephone number is 602-539-9580. 602-539-9580. And toll-free at 1-888-223-4599. If you have a question or a comment for our guest, Lloyd Auerbach, please feel free to call, and we'll let you talk with him. If you live outside of the United States, you live in Europe, you live in Australia, you live in Asia, you live in Africa, or if you live on Nibiru, you can, you don't want to make that long distance call and spend the money. You can use our flash message feature. Just go over to my website, kevinsmithshow.com, and scroll down. You'll see it in green letters. It says flash message. You can send me a flash message, and I'll read it, and we'll get our guest to talk about it, to comment on it. Lloyd, in all the years that you've been doing paranormal investigations, have you run across any situations where you went away from it saying, yep, this is the real thing, there are ghosts here?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, that goes back for me quite a long time. We've had many cases where that was the best explanation. I had one in 85, in fact, with a family that had all independently been seeing the ghosts but not talking to each other until their 12-year-old son got them all to talk about the ghosts because he said the ghost was telling him that he should. And we had some really interesting conversations with the kid, and through him, the ghost, who was apparently in the room with us, that gave us not only information about the history of the area, which really, you know, he could have picked up in other places, but it led us to track to find the woman's, the ghost's only living relative, and verify family stories this kid was relating to us from the ghost.
Is that an isolated incident, or have you had a bunch of those?
We've had a bunch of cases. I mean, that's one of the best ones that had no contamination, and I think it was one of really incredible detail. But I've had a number of other cases where there has been enough interaction to show that there's somebody present.
Mm-hmm.
Even had cases of, for example, this one restaurant that we do at the Moss Beach Distillery, one of the psychics provided us with information about the history of the location, which we really couldn't verify, because it was the place had been a center for bootleggers in the Prohibition, and it was about there having been raids on the Smugglers Beach below. We couldn't find anything historically, because those records would have been locked up in law enforcement from the 1930s, early 30s, and trying to find that stuff would be next to impossible. And then on another case, the USS Hornet Aircraft Carrier Museum, which is apparently haunted by lots of guys, the former curator of the museum who we were interviewing happened to have been a kid in the Bay Area who saw the ghost when he was a kid. And not only that, his dad was an attorney for the state of California. And he started describing, I said, well, did your dad ever tell you anything about the history of the place? And he said, well, my dad was an attorney for California during Prohibition, and he went on these three major raids on the Smugglers Beach below the restaurant. And he started describing exactly what the psychic had given us. So we get these cross correspondences sometimes between cases that are really pretty amazing. And some of what's related to us by people, I mean, it becomes, again, for me, the best explanation for some few cases, relative to the number of cases I've done, has been conscious beings, apparitions.
All right, so what do you think is happening with these conscious beings? What's the deal? Why are they hanging around?
Well, the reason they hang around is different than the physical, the actual conditions, but each one of them has their own personal reasons for sticking around. There seems that the common factors are things that people are afraid to move on, or that they are they want to stay with their family, they want to stay with the place, they don't know what to do next. There's any number of reasons, but there seems to be that intense psychological, emotional desire to stay. There seems to be most likely some environmental conditions either at or after the time of death that allow them to stay. Otherwise, we'd have a whole lot more ghosts than we actually have reported. And, you know, there could be that spiritual component if you want to reach into the realm of God. There may be a bigger plan for people. We don't know. But clearly, not everybody stays around. Otherwise, we'd never have a reincarnation. And we'd never have mediums able to talk to people on the other side.
Yeah. All right, caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling? Hello, caller.
Hi, Kevin. This is Ryan in Washington.
Yeah, Ryan.
Well, that's a very mind-expanding show tonight.
Good deal.
Yeah, my question is, does your guest think that, has he done any studies on the human, does a human, let me see what how I was going to phrase it, what I was going to ask. Well, let me just ask this. What does he think of deja vu, like when somebody has a deja vu experience?
Okay.
I've had that happen to me several times where I would be someplace or somewhere or something, and I would remember being there at a previous time, almost like it was kind of like
you were reliving it.
Living what I something that I've already experienced. It's almost unreal.
Yeah.
When that happens, I just wanted to know what you thought about that. I'll just take it off the air.
All right. Thanks for the call. Before we get into that, let me say we're 10 seconds away from a break. So, Ryan, we'll get Lloyd to comment on deja vu when we come back from this break, all right? And, folks, don't go away. We'll be right back on the other side. And welcome back. We're on Final Approach. My guest this evening is Lloyd Auerbach. And we're talking about things paranormal from the perspective of science, really, parapsychology. And there is a debate even today, Lloyd, as to whether psychology is science.
Right. I would agree with that. I think that, and people tend to forget that psychology, anthropology, sociology, or social sciences, as opposed to the hard sciences, the physical sciences like physics and chemistry.
All right, folks, we're going to open up the telephone line again. We'll have time for one or two calls.
We have that question about deja vu.
Yeah, let me give the telephone numbers. The telephone numbers, ladies and gentlemen, are, if you can call without it being a long-distance call for you, 602-539-9580. Or if it would be long-distance, you can call me on the toll-free number, 1-888-223-4599. All right, now Ryan had asked a question, the question being, what about deja vu? So we have a caller on hold. Caller, hang on. And Lloyd, if you'll take that question.
Well, briefly, deja vu is the experience of having been there before, having experienced something before, and it does certainly fall into parapsychology research. Dr. Vernon Nepi, who is up in Seattle area, actually wrote a book years ago as part of his doctoral dissertation in South Africa, but he's reprinted and actually updated the book, which is available on his website. And it's kind of interesting because he came up with 44 possible explanations for deja vu, which included psychic ones and non-psychic ones. It's everything from you are precognitive before you even walk into the place. You get a sense of the place, and so now it feels like you've been there before. Or maybe you were there before in some past life, or maybe you're just simply having a little perceptual hiccup. There's any number of possibilities for that. You may have even had a dream that you're suddenly remembering, having had a dream about coming to that location.
Okay. Caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Yeah, hi, this is Kevin from Northern Alberta calling.
Hi, Kevin.
Hi. I'd like to ask Lloyd, does the power of intention or trying to connect with the overall consciousness fit into parapsychology at all?
It absolutely does. In fact, you might say that psychokinesis, mind-matter interaction, is about intention. We intend to do something, to make something move. We intend to heal. And there's a lot of research on the power of intention, including a research piece that was printed, published in the journal Explorer a couple of years ago, looking at putting the power of intention, or even an intent, into food to see if it has an effect. And that food substance happened to be my favorite, which was chocolate.
And did it?
And is there certain, well, I was just going to ask if there's certain ways of practicing this that are better than others?
You know, there are any number of methods, depending on what you want to accomplish, but certainly putting the idea out into the universe, just thinking about an intention, putting it out, can perhaps put you both in the mind frame to be open to things that come to you that you recognize. I mean, it may not even be psychic in the sense, that it allows you to be open to opportunities, to be watchful, that even unconsciously. That's from the skeptical side. From the parapsychological side, it may actually cause things to help you, I guess you could say, affect luck a little bit, to push things in your direction a little bit more.
Okay, well, thank you, and what a great show. Thank you very much.
All right, thanks for the call. 602-539-9580 or 1-888-223-4599, toll free if the other number would be long distance for you. Well, Lloyd, you know, one of the things that I guess it's sort of an observation and social comment, but it's one of the things that sort of disturbs me about what I see being written and hear being said when the so-called reasonable, rational people talk about the paranormal and they poo-poo the idea. I mentioned it earlier. It's those black and white statements. And, you know, the claims of knowing, we know this, we know that. And when you get into the whole field of knowing, you're getting into epistemology, you're getting into how do you know that you know? And you said, and I agree, that virtually everything comes down to belief.
It's subjective.
Yeah. It's subjective. But I see all around us a society that's pretty much been built on the basis of black and white statements, hard line statements about things that people really don't know, but they believe and believe strongly and want to enforce it as if it is a fact that's established.
Well, I think the unknown is scary to people. I think that people are, rather than being purely curious about the unknown, they are afraid. They're afraid of change. People are not comfortable with change. I think that's just who we are as human beings in general. This certainly is a problem in a lot of areas. People are afraid of the other, of the stranger. That's things that are programmed into us. We're afraid of predators in the dark.
Mm-hmm.
So there's any number of things that may be instinct that prevent us from being this way, because again, we're a biological entity, we're animals. It's about surpassing that as human beings that is really important. We have to get beyond that and be open to new ideas, but again, not so open as to accept everything, because you can't figure out things that don't work too.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, if the definition of paranormal, and this is a widely accepted definition, paranormal is anything for which there is no scientific explanation. Well, if that is the definition, then virtually everything in the universe is paranormal.
Well, that actually makes dark matter paranormal.
Yeah. It makes dark matter. It makes gravity paranormal because they can't figure out whether that, you know, if it is a wave, then you ought to be able to modulate it. And why can't we? And I mean, you know, there are no scientific explanations for almost everything.
Right, that's correct. You know, and Kathleen Sky, who was a science fiction writer, said years ago, there's no such thing as the supernatural. There are only things we don't understand yet.
I would accept that. I think the paranormal is very normal, but it's just something we don't really understand yet.
You know, so many people have psychic experiences on a yearly basis that, as I mentioned earlier, that if you just go by the numbers, if we define normal as the state that most people are in most of the time, then perhaps it's rarer than everybody having the experience, but it is absolutely, psychic experiences are not paranormal. They're normal. They're in the normal range of human experience. They just need to be looked at.
Lloyd, we're almost out of time, and I want to remind folks that if you go to my website and you see Lloyd's picture, just click on it. It will take you over to his website. And that's the new way we're doing things. Instead of putting a text link, folks, the guest picture, just click on the guest picture, and it'll take you to their website. And you really should go over there and enjoy that website. It is it's a journey in itself. A lot of information there. Lloyd, I want to thank you for being with us this evening. It's been fascinating.
Thanks, Kevin, for an interesting discussion.
Well, I don't get to have discussions, deep discussions like this, with every topic that we do on the show. They don't all lend themselves to it. But I want to thank you for being willing to engage in that and to really kind of take us on the journey. If you will, stay on the phone with me for just a moment, because I'd like to talk with you for a moment, just a moment, after the show closes.
Absolutely.
All right. Folks, Lloyd Auerbach, and I mean it, you really ought to go over and visit his website. So just click on his picture and it'll take you there. My friends call me Steel Eye. My enemies do too. You can call me whatever you'd like. Just keep coming back again and again and again. Until next time, so long, everybody.